Yeah, they weren't tough enough.
Good afternoon. I'm just ringing the bell to make you aware that you are now on air. So everything you want to say can be heard by the people watching us, so be careful. This is for those who want to have side conversations. Please be aware that you can be heard. Very good afternoon to everyone. Welcome to this roundtable on behalf of FASB and ISB. We had already one this morning, quite large group. I think we are a bit less numerous this afternoon. That doesn't mean we will not have a very fruitful discussion, I'm sure. Maybe we could start with a quick introduction, tour de table. This time I will start to my wife.
Lisa Muehlbauer, FASB staff.
Matt Esposito, FASB staff.
I'm Simon Clinton from Tesco, but I'm also representing the views of the European Retail Roundtable.
Andrew Buchanan, BDO.
Jørgen Engstrøm, ISB.
Søren Olsen from Novo Nordisk in Denmark. It's a Danish-based pharmaceutical company with activities in more than 180 countries.
Hal Schroeder, FASB.
Martin Perry from BP.
Sue Casper, FASB staff.
Stephen Cooper, ISB.
Emmanuel Cordano from Sanofi, pharmaceutical company also. But I'm also representing the views of Business Europe.
Jacqueline Mills from Nice Europe.
No, don't push it again. Okay. You don't have to touch your mic.
Okay, you've got it all under control. Yes, Richard Martin, I'm from the Association of Chartered Certified Accountants.
Andrew Saunders from the European Public Real Estate Association.
Henry Rees, ISB staff.
Dan Knightley, EY.
Hermann Kleimans, staff of the German National Senate Center, ACG.
Martin Bosch, Eumelian.
Brian O'Donovan from KPMG.
Jim Croker, FASB.
Good afternoon, Anna Heining, ISB staff.
Trina Buchanan, ISB staff.
Philippe Danjou, ISB. Ted, maybe you just joined the table, so yeah. You can introduce yourself.
Ted Parkin from ABB. Good afternoon.
Okay. And we have on the screen, we have a couple of staff members from FASB Norwalk. Hi, can you introduce yourselves?
Hi, Danielle Zayer, FASB staff.
Scott Muir, FASB staff.
Hello, Colin Walsh, FASB staff.
Sydney Traub, FASB staff.
Okay, thank you. Maybe about the protocol for taking the floor, I would like you not to touch your mics. They are all on. Stay as they are. But if you want to take the floor, please put your name card up, and I will take note of who wants to speak. And if you have a pressing need to react to something which has been said by one of the participants, please raise two hands. I will see that you want to react immediately to the remarks. And I pretty much hope that there will be some interaction between yourselves. Okay, so we have an agenda for the afternoon, but maybe before we tee off with the discussion topics, and knowing that we do not plan to reopen fundamentally the basic assumption that all leases should be on balance sheet if they are material, i.e., presumably if they are more than 12 months in duration, and that is the assumption for this afternoon's discussion. All the question is how to do it, not whether or not to do it. But still, I know that some of you may have a strong view in support or against this basic hypothesis, and maybe we can do a very quick tour de table on this issue. Who wants to take the floor? Jacqueline, how much? It was for you, obviously.
Thank you for the opportunity. I think that Lease Europe believes that there are different leases with different economics. We think that those different economics should not necessarily drive measurement, but should drive recognition. Lease Europe doesn't think that IAS 17 is as broken as the boards have made it out to be. We think that the 6 or 7 years of the right of use project have shown that it's actually extremely difficult, if not impossible, to make the right of use model work in practice. And as was said earlier this morning, we understand that different users have different views, different ways of viewing arrangements that are called leases, and that they require different kinds of information. And our suggestion now to take things forward would be that we actually go back to the IE17 model and look at ways of how we can provide users with those disclosures that would help them make the calculations and do the analysis that they need to do.
Thank you. Not a surprise to hear you. Can I have any reactions to that? Does anyone want to ask questions or express a totally diametrically opposed view on that? Maybe Martin, can I invite you to take as an investor, as a user?
Yeah. From an investor perspective, lease obligations are a form of financial debt. They are financial obligations, financing. And it's basically irrespective of whether it's like an operating lease or currently a financing lease, whether investors regard both of them as a form of financing. And actually, I know of no professional analyst that does not take leases into account. Any analyst will try to get their hands behind what's now the true, what's now my assessment of the financing component of the in particular obligating operating lease obligation. So this is all one big circus, because what have we got? We have, on the one hand, we have companies reporting information. They have all the facts, and they're providing the facts in disclosures. And on the other hand, we have the investors that take those very summarized disclosures and put them back on the balance sheet. It's not only a big circuit, it's also costly and a waste of time. It makes it much more expensive for the analyst community to understand what the financial position, leverage, and operating performance is of companies. So we could do each other a huge favor by making companies from the analysis perspective less risky. Because if there is a way to get them economically on the balance sheet, I think the standard setter should grab its responsibility and do so.
I would like to welcome Henk Verhoek from the European FEE, just joined the table for those in Norwalk.
Thank you. Sorry for being delayed.
Okay, no problem. We just started. All right, Jacqueline, I know that. Just a minute. Maybe I will have maybe Soren as a preparer.
Yes, that's correct. We are a preparer with who are a leasing. Overall, we think it's a good standard. It's well written, and it's fairly easy to understand, I hope. And we do also acknowledge the need from the investor side, and so therefore we can understand the background of the standard. What we are concerned about is the huge administrative burden that we are facing. And I think we have also this morning talked about water coolers and coffee machines and so on. But it would be interesting to hear how the investor sees it. Is it the core assets that are interesting to get on the balance sheet, or is it also the water coolers?
We'll get back to the discussion on the scope and the simplifications. So I think we're just here on the basic premise. And let's assume we talk about material items to simplify. I will ask Simon.
Yes, thank you. So I can understand the take of some of the investor community that leasing is a form of finance, and I think it is for some assets and some arrangements. However, in particular, when you're looking at property assets where there isn't an alternative. So a lot of property leases are taken because there simply isn't an alternative to getting that property by buying it and raising finance. And so the lease is simply a form of obtaining the properties that are required. And on that basis, you can't bucket them all together and say all leases are finance leases. You need to be quite particular and understand what the underlying economics and the drivers are behind the setting up of the leases, which is why it's useful to see the differentiation between property leases and other types of leases within the EE as it is. But I don't think it goes far enough. We don't think that property leases in general should be on the balance sheet.
Does that mean you think you don't have a liability?
I don't think we have a financing liability, no.
No, that's a liability.
Well, do we think that we have a trigger event for the liability until the conditions of the lease have been satisfied, i.e. the property is continued to be made available, the various service conditions that will typically apply behind property leases, and so on. No, not until those things are satisfied.
Are there any situations where you think it should be on the balance sheet?
For property?
Yeah.
I haven't been able to think of some. It doesn't mean that there aren't any, but I haven't been able to think of any.
Do you have any warehouses, I suppose? The school does have its own warehouses?
Absolutely.
Short-term leases, long-term? In comparison to the useful life of the building?
Typically, a combination of both, actually. So we would typically use leases when it comes to distribution centres for risk mitigation, so to not tie ourselves into long-term property ownership.
Do analysts that follow you do anything to put those leases on balance sheet?
Analysts that follow us do all sorts of things. So there is a combination of putting some on, some put some on balance sheet, others don't look at it in that light, no.
Jacqueline, you have a right to come back.
Thank you very much. I promise I will be brief, and a lot of what I wanted to say has actually already been said by other people around the table. We disagree that all leases are financings. Like I said, we think there are different leases with different economics. That doesn't mean that some of them are not. And those that are should be on the balance sheet, and we think that I-17 is actually quite a good way of recognizing those transactions that are financing transactions. But equally, there are plenty of property leases. Also, the kinds of equipment leases that were mentioned by Soren earlier on, and also outsourcing arrangements that use lease documentation in them to make assets available within a kind of servicing context to businesses that are not financing transactions. At least they're not more or less financing transactions than any other kind of contractual arrangement. And I think that our feeling is that we just don't understand why the line is being drawn where it is. I know we will get to scope, so I won't go into any more detail. But there are plenty of other arrangements where you could say you do have a liability. Why just single out those leases why single out some kinds of leases and not look at all different kinds of contractual commitments? And one other comment I wanted to make is that I think that the burden for preparers now in terms of implementing the standard and applying it going forward would significantly outweigh any benefits that would be inherent in the proposals for users, if there are any. I think the boards themselves recognize in the ED, in the basis of conclusions, that users will continue to make adjustments. Like Simon just said, analysts, users, they do a whole lot of things. So our solution would be to provide them with as much information as we can in the notes in a way that is cost efficient for the preparer of accounts, but without fundamentally changing the model, which we believe does not work in practice and is not sufficiently mature yet in terms of its conceptual basis.
I think we will hear from preparers on the cost benefit, and they will tell us what they think about the cost and the benefits, and probably they are more on the front line than the leasing industry itself to assess the cost benefits for preparers and users. And Richard.
Thank you. Well, I would say we are very much in agreement with what Jacqueline has been saying from Lease Europe and the other comments that we've had. I think we don't think that IS-17
is as wrong as perhaps has been made out. But I think the key thing is that certain leases are in the nature of financing transactions, and certain leases are not, are more in the nature of a provision of a service. And we think you should be looking in a way at the IS 17 and trying to improve that, because I do think that the IS 17 threshold is rather high and should probably be brought down, and more items included in the financing the finance lease the finance lease category. Like others, we've looked at these proposals, and there is going to be a lot of complexity for preparers, certainly making a lot of judgments. I'm sure we'll come on to some of those boundaries, but that does mean the results can be quite complex to interpret as well when we have the complexity of preparation. It does tend to go.
We will get back to measurement and complexities later on. I think we are still here on the basic premise, either a liability, financial or other, to be booked and an asset. Before I move to the accounting profession, the auditors and standard setter, I would like to have a first reaction by investors. Martin, to what you heard.
Well, it's interesting to hear that there's a thought that maybe not all leases are financing arrangements. I can imagine that we have to keep in mind here, for whom do we produce the external financial reporting? It's not management information, it's external financial reporting for the user. And among the user community, there is absolutely no doubt whether a lease of a property or a lease of a car has a financing component, and it's an obligation. And the only thing, and that's interesting, because the ISB and the FESB in the ED strike it exactly right. I mean, there should be an asset involved, and that's the and it should be controlled. So take or pay contracts, they shouldn't be there. I agree. And service is excluded, but it's already excluded. So that's not new. Financial statements are prepared for users, and users regard them as financing. So, service user.
Thank you. So let's have views from technical experts, accounting experts, and I think I will start with the German standard setter, Hermann.
Yeah, thank you. The IFRS committee, of course, looks at the whole issue from a conceptual point of view. And using the right of use approach, they, of course, would support that there is one model according to which all such leases should be addressed, and they should all be addressed alike. One model for all leases, and preferably symmetrically for lessees and lessors. However, the IFRS committee acknowledge that there are constituents who would like to differentiate between the leases which are on one hand rather financing activities and others which are not. And this is why, although not wholeheartedly supporting the approach proposed by the boards, they would support the approach to be implemented for lessees if users would confirm that they can use and work with that information provided to them. And they would not need to make adjustments as they do right now. And a different consequence would have been taken for lessors. For lessors, the IFRS committee recommends not to implement the right of use approach, because currently there are still too many issues with that approach for lessors. So the proposal would be to stick with the type B approach for lessors, which is more or less the approach as we have it right now in IAS 17 for operating leases. And of course, the legacy requirements for finance leases, that should be retained as well, because in that instance, control has been passed from the lessor to the lessee. This is the position the IFRS committee takes.
Thank you. Andrew.
Thank you. We would support the right of use model primarily because we believe that leases do give rise to assets and liabilities. We don't distinguish between leases of particular types of assets because we don't think that changes the conclusion in whether you have a financing component or not. So that it's very much looking at it in the basis that if you finance an asset for part of its life, that's a financing transaction, and if you finance it for the whole of its life, that's also a financing transaction. In terms of the model in the exposure draft,
I was just going to say, I don't mean to be rude, Andrew, at all. I just realised that we do intend to go into the specific, you know, topics in the paper to single, etc. And I'm sorry, I know the conversation's gone that way. So
going that way summarize, I'll do a high level.
Do you support having these on balance sheet, yes or no?
Right, and I'm sure I'll get an opportunity to pitch in later on. We do support it. We see no difference in it. And we think that if there is a lease which has periodic payments attached to it, then there is no question that if a lump sum was paid up front, there would be a discount.
Thanks. Dan, for a while.
In spirit of brevity, I would support leases recognized on the balance sheet if it's done in a practical and principled manner and provides users of financial statements with the relevant information they need.
Thank you. Quick shot. Thank you for the European Federation. No, don't touch it. Don't touch the mic. Press it again. And don't touch it, though, forever.
Technical.
Okay. I speak here. I represent the FEE, the European Force of Accountants. The FEE basically supports the model, the right of use model. But we think that this model still needs a conceptual basis, conceptual thinking. What we see is that this, what is presented in this idea could give complexities, as already have been said, complexities for not only for preparers, but also for users, we think. Do users really understand what is going on and why the model for lessors is very different from the model for lessees? So we think these models will add complexity and are lacking a robust conceptual basis.
Brian, maybe a different opinion, I guess.
Again, briefly, I think your question was, should leases be on balance sheet? I'm afraid that I think it's inappropriate to focus just on that single aspect without considering the model as a whole. I would say if it was possible to have a conceptually coherent model for lessees and lessors for which the benefits outweigh the costs, then I can see a case for leases being on balance sheet. But if it's not possible to do that, perhaps it's necessary to look at other things. A number of people who spoke in support of leases being on balance sheet referred to them as being financing transactions. Under these proposals, some leases are financing transactions for one party and not for the other, and sometimes they're financing transactions in one part of financial statements but not in the other. So, as I say, as part of a conceptually coherent benefits outweigh the costs proposals, we would support leases being on balance sheet. But if that's not achievable, then I think it's necessary to look at other approaches.
Right, so maybe a first set of reactions from board members. Jan?
Yeah, just to explain my view on why it's important to have it on the balance sheet. I would be very happy to say we can make a disclosure project of this, make use of that information. So what did we do? We tried to get quite a few investment reports from investment bankers and said, what do they do? And we also met, as Petrina will tell you within short, quite a number of analysts, and we discussed with them how they do their analysis. And we learned that they use a factor of annual leasing expenses times 8 or possibly 7. Seemed to be almost a global informal standard for doing that. So we took 700 European companies, and with the help of some other people, staff made an analysis of saying, if we take these 700 companies, we take the leasing expenses and we multiply by 8, we get the number. Then we take the notes and we see what is written in the notes, and we discount that with 5% interest rate. And what do we get? Well, we got 55%, let's call it real liability, in relation to the 8 times factor. We also made some less sophisticated views on what would the whole asset be, considering the 8 times or 7 times factor. In both cases, we get absolutely wrong information. We get twice, almost, the liability of these 700 big European companies. So for me, that is a proof that today's model doesn't work. It's not enough to have it in the disclosures. And I said in a meeting with a group of analysts, I said, I think you're lazy. You don't read 2 pages of disclosures. And why should you read, why should we expect you to read 5 or 6 pages? So I think if we don't get this on the balance sheet, we won't get the information, and we will continue to see equity and credit analysts doing the same mistakes.
Thank you. Maybe it's a good transition about the outreach activities, and I think Patrina wanted to tell you about what we've been doing so far to get the feedback from users. Maybe you can, in continuation of Jan's remark.
Thank you, Philippe. And by the way, after this, we intend to absolutely get into the questions in the paper, so I plan to be brief. To just let you know just a bit about where we are in the process of course, feeding, getting all of the very important feedback on this project, that since publishing the exposure draft in May, we have spent our time, I suppose, trying to get out and about, speaking to a lot of you and others, really with a very particular focus on the costs and benefits of the proposals, of course, that those words will certainly have been and will be mentioned today. And that, of course, is fundamental to the boards as well in terms of coming up with any proposed change. So where we are is we've had a number of outreach meetings. On the benefits side, we really focused on speaking to as many investors and analysts as possible. We also have spent some time doing what we call fieldwork meetings with some preparers. And when we use that term, we mean it in the context of having individual meetings with lessees and lessors, spending half a day to a day with each, really trying to talk in detail about what will be the costs of implementation and what are the drivers of those costs. Obviously with the hope that puts the boards in a much more informed position in assessing, are there particular aspects of the proposals that are going to drive a significant amount of cost where potentially there isn't an equivalent amount of benefit. That, of course, forms, by the way, part, like these round tables do, of the overall feedback. We, of course, from this point forward, hope and know we will get lots of more input from the comment letters and at the round tables, including this one and the others to come. So just to give you maybe a very high level of what we've heard so far, particularly from investors and analysts, because that's a part of our constituency that, of course, don't tend to write us so many comment letters or obviously come to things like round tables. So at this point, we've had over 35 meetings with something like 220 investors and analysts around the world. We still have a few more meetings to come. We've spoken to them in Europe, in the United States, in Hong Kong, in Japan, in Australasia, in South Africa. It includes credit rating agencies, other credit analysts, of course, equity analysts, and covering both buy side and sell side. And the focus of those discussions were primarily on lessee accounting. And I suppose from those meetings, we can only reiterate what Martijn was saying, that we feel we do have broad support for the lessee accounting proposals from analysts and investors. Almost all of those we've spoken to do think that leases create assets and liabilities, and that's reflected in the fact that almost all of them are making adjustments today to capitalise operating leases. There are somewhat different views from equity analysts compared to credit analysts. The equity analysts, of course, focus their focus is not only on risk. They're often focused primarily on assessing the operating performance of a company, and they tend to do things in slightly different ways. Some of the equity analysts are trying to get to the lessee's contractual commitments, and for those analysts, they wholeheartedly agree with the proposals. For some of those are more focused when they're thinking about operating performance on looking at a whole life or a whole asset number. That's particularly those that maybe follow sectors where you've got individual companies that own a lot of their assets versus lease a lot of their assets. So, for example, some of the airline analysts that we've spoken to, the strong focus in trying to get comparability between owned and leased, and like to try and get at a whole asset number. We have some that we've spoken to who are focused on the liability side, on the lease commitments, but they make adjustments to try and get at an ongoing perpetual commitment, assuming that the company continues to operate as it does today. In saying that, overall, still the majority of equity analysts do support the proposals. They made it clear that in assessing any entity, they have to assess risk as well as operating performance, and that the proposals would certainly give them much better information about the risk and about the leverage of the company. Now, credit analysts are pretty unanimous in their support for the proposals. And for them, leases create assets and liabilities, and not just any liabilities, they create debt-like liabilities, in their view. So having a lessee's contractual commitments recognised and measured on a consistent basis, they think will be a real improvement to financial reporting and would certainly reduce their costs going forward. And the credit rating agencies are also supportive of the proposals for similar reasons. In terms of the fieldwork meetings and what we've heard when we've spoken individually to preparers, just to give you a bit of background, when we've had those meetings, we have gone to the preparers' premises. And the idea with that is we really wanted to get access to more than just potentially the accounting personnel. We've tried to speak to the people who are involved in IT, who are involved in writing the contracts, the legal departments, the investor relations, really hoping to get at that in-depth understanding. So far, we've had 14 of those fieldwork meetings, and that process is ongoing. We have another 11 to 12 already arranged coming up, and that may increase. I think at all of those meetings, it's fair to say that some concerns have been raised about cost and complexity. We've heard some concerns about complexity added from having a dual lessee accounting approach. There have been some concerns around exactly determining the lease term, assessing significant economic incentive. We've heard some concerns about separating lease and service components, some concerns about reassessment, having to reassess variable lease payments or lease term. And also there has been some requests for more guidance around the definition of a lease and also things like the notion of in-substance payments. So overall, I think the general message we're getting from those fieldwork meetings is that there could and should be some simplifications made that could reduce the cost and complexity significantly. But overall, based on those meetings to date, we would conclude that the proposals are certainly doable.
So with that in mind, and after having heard your opening remarks, I would like you to take as a working assumption for the continuation of this discussion that the board will confirm that leases will be on balance sheet, provided they are not immaterial, and that the question now is how to do it. And maybe the first series of questions is, as Petrina said, the dual model or single model, and maybe we could move to the first questions. You want to rephrase the questions for those who listen to us?
Sure. Sorry. So if we go into the actual paper, we'll look now at topic one. Topic one, of course, addresses overall lessee accounting model, as well as the overall lessor accounting model. There are four questions here, questions 1 to 4. What I'd like to do is split the discussion to first of all talk about the lessee accounting proposals, and then afterwards discuss the lessor accounting proposals. So maybe if we take questions 1 and 2 together, and obviously question 4 filters into all of this, discussing lessee accounting, and I suppose to get your views on those proposals. Do you think leases are economically so different that there should be more than one accounting model from a lessee perspective? And if so, what should that dual model be? And so maybe if we spend about the next 30 minutes discussing your views on lessee accounting.
Open. Martin, then Emmanuel, and then another Martin. So let's start with Martin.
Yes.
Do I pronounce it well?
Sorry, I thought of... sorry, what is your question?
Do I pronounce it well? Martin.
Yeah, Martin. That's
okay, good. Thank you.
Perfect. What do we do as an analyst with those lease obligations? What's the purpose? Eh? So we make adjustments to be able to compare the one company that has a little bit more leases with the other company that has maybe a little bit less leases or no leases. And we want to be able to compare the company with its own performance in previous years. So if the lease exposure varies over time, we want to be able to judge the operating performance of that company. Now, what is now one of the key things that that's interesting for us to know is to model the cash flows that are required for a company to grow. And to model those cash flows, you need to know what the asset intensity is of a particular business model. Now, this, if you add all these elements together, that means that you need to break down the lease expense in a way that reflects the actual assets leased. And that allows you to, with much more certainty, understand what the business is all about and how it compares to the one to another. What we do currently is provide a judgment, okay, we have these kind of liabilities, well, we see fixed assets that have an average life of maybe like 8 years. Let's assume 8 years. And then this beautifully results in a split between interest and, say, cash depreciation, the consumption concept. This is of course very judgmental, and the good thing about the model that the ISB and the FESB have come up with is that indeed this dual model is the best proxy for making a split that is based on the underlying economics. Any other model that the boards have evaluated is not have got nothing to do with trying to reflect what any differentiation between the underlying assets. So I think this is like a compromise. We get just enough information to get this split. The split is provided on the best effort without actually asking preparers for average life of those leased assets, which they may not know. So this is like a practical expedient to get to a result that is highly interpretable for the analyst.
Let's get some views from the preparers community, and starting with Emmanuel for Business Europe.
So we understand the assumption that leases should be on the balance sheet, and we hear also your point about comparability. And at Business Europe, we have had many discussions. Business Europe is a large organization with many industries and many preparers. So we have had discussions. Some were supporters or balance sheet in more leases in the balance sheet. And those are not very happy with the proposal today because they wanted the leases on the balance sheet for simplicity reasons, and the type A, type B was did not reach the objective. But I think most of the preparers are really challenging the fact that all leases should be on the balance sheet. And even though they agree with the right of use, I think we are all at business, you are very attached to very sound definitions. And this is maybe something that users don't really see as much as we do as preparers, but we really are attached to very sound definitions. So there is a right of use model, but there is also an access model. We are using some of some assets, but they are more of a service than right of use, and we consider that for this more service where the component of service is more important than the right of use, it should be accounted off balance sheet. And there is another type of assets that we consider are not should not be on the balance sheet, and that's for comparability reason. It's the assets that actually are used by the employees. We consider that for comparability purpose, they are more in substance compensation, and for that reason, they should be on, they should not be on the balance sheet.
And you mean the company cars, the fleet of cars?
Yeah, but even a coffee machine could be considered as used by the employees.
Can I just clarify, in terms of saying that a lot of your views are that they agree with the right of use model, but maybe not all, is it a kind of materiality, small ticket lease type of issue that you think we potentially are trying to capture assets where there will be quite small values? Or is it more that you're thinking there's a pot of assets that you use that are services, are not leases? So is it a materiality question or is it a...
For some preparers, it was a materiality. Those who are in favor of the leases in the balance sheet would really appreciate some simplification on the amount or the ticket or the assets. But others were are really attached to the service part and consider that, if it's a buy versus lease type of asset, it should be on the balance sheet. But in some situation where it's more for the service part, but the company would not buy the asset, it would be a service asset that shouldn't be on the balance sheet.
We will have some time for discussing the definition of a lease as compared to a service and the guidance that we provide and whether it's clear enough. So for the continuation, let's assume that it's a lease. Okay. So the question is one type or two types. Martin, on behalf of BP.
Yeah, thank you. So we agree that there are different types of lease, but we don't agree that it's necessary or that it's cost-benefit, the cost outweigh the benefits of doing the work on an individual lease-by-lease basis, that all contracts need to be analysed in order to do that. So while we kind of see the conceptual basis that consumption is a good basis, or at least consumption is a factor, a good factor for differentiating between different types of leases. I think the costs and benefits aren't outweighed there, and that one of the big advantages of the 2010 ED was it had a single model, which is much more simple, and we feel that this is therefore a step backwards in having two different models that require us to classify leases on a lease-by-lease basis, and that the operating versus finance lease analysis will kind of be continued through a different route going forwards. So I'll talk about consumption in a minute, but if we're going to... we would rather there just be one single model, or at least each preparer should be allowed to have a single model. And whether that is achieved by having just one single model in the final standard, or whether there are two models available, type A and type B, but there's an accounting policy choice. So we who have a lot of equipment, not so much property, we would probably choose to have go for type A for all of our leases. That would be much more simple to operationalise. Maybe companies that have got essentially large amounts of property and not so much equipment, they could go for type B for all of this. That might be a way of operationalising it and making it simpler. But we think that would be, it does add unnecessary complexity.
So what happens when you've got a company that's roughly evenly split? What do they do?
I think they would have to make a choice.
Okay. And that would be along what lines? What would be the guiding light to help them decide between A and B?
I think you could go what's more predominant, but if you're in a 50-50, then I think a free choice.
Coin flip. Okay.
You think that would...
Well, not a coin flip, I think a free choice. They would think about what's the best way for them to present it. They might talk to their investors.
Do you think that would achieve comparability between two companies, one choosing A and one choosing B?
I think that there's... I mean, clearly no. But within industries, then it's quite like it's pretty likely that there would be convergence within industries, if not necessarily between industries. So I think that complexity is a big point against the type A, type B. I think the fundamental principle. I think this goes back to the approach C that we had in the 2000 and early 2012 model with a continuous analysis amongst different types of consumption. I think that having this split, it almost gets there if we are going to have two different models, but. We've done some modelling and run some numbers, and pretty much for any kind of equipment, it comes out as type B. So anything that is not property, just don't really see why you need to have the choice. I can see that for property, so for short term and medium term property, that the amount of consumption that's embedded in each lease payment. I think that's an interesting point. That it's not consumption of the asset over the lease term that's really, really important here. It's how much consumption each lease payment contains that is a more important driver. And so when you're talking about medium, short-term property leases, I can see that those are different, and we see that those are different. But for us, the cost benefit of having to make analysis on a lease-by-lease basis of whether something's been consumed or not, we don't think it's there.
I see that your comments do raise a lot of reactions to the left, but maybe another view from preparers, Ted Parkin from ABB.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, as a preparer, I mean, we looked at the new exposure draft, and we had this conceptual conflict whether a lease has a dual nature, which is what we've discussed well already, is financing on one hand, but on the other hand, more of a right to use or a rental kind of concept or a usage concept. Or does a lease have just a financing nature? And in this particular scenario, if I understand correctly, we're on the presumption that all leases for the lessee should be on the balance sheet. Well, to us, the overriding conceptual point for that is that all leases are financing. So if that's the presumption what we're talking about as a preparer, it was more conceptually consistent for us that all leases are financing in nature. That's why they're on the balance sheet. That's why we have a right to use asset. In that regard, we would only have one model. And that would be a financing type model that's more reflective of like the type A that's in the exposure draft. And to us, that conceptually held together, where we, you know, had some difficulty whether it's okay on one hand it's actually dual purpose, but on the other hand it's always for the lessee of financing. And to us, we came to a lot of conceptual challenges in that regard.
Thanks.
And that presumption, I think the most clear conceptual model would be one financing or something built around the type A.
Before I give the floor to the accounting profession and standard setters and back to the investors, I will take one more reaction from the preparer side. Simon.
Thank you.
So to move things along would take the assumption that things are on the balance sheet. I mean, I think you understand my position on that. The property leases shouldn't be on the balance sheet, but to move things along. In terms of whether there should be two models or not, I mean, clearly, if property leases are sufficiently different not to be on the balance sheet, then a two-model approach would be what we favour. And in particular, I mean, one of the things that we thought was really useful about the Type B approach as laid out is the straight lining of the effect through the income statement, which we believe does reflect performance and sort of the underlying costs to the business. So I don't think we'd be in favour of losing sight of that as we are, and I think that straight line approach would be pretty useful for our users, the readers of the accounts as well. In terms of whether that's more complex than what we have currently, well, clearly we have two models currently, so if you keep on with two models, that feels as though that's something we can cope with. However, within the Type B model as it is laid out at the moment, there feels as though there are some pretty significant issues with the way that asset book values will be calculated, particularly with the effectively a balancing item for depreciation, which basically means that at any given time, the net book value of the right of use assets, which could be the first or second largest item in the assets for a fair number of retailers, may be put together on a less rigorous basis than some of the other numbers within the balance sheet, and clearly that would have impacts on users, in particular when they're using returns on asset ratios, and whether those are meaningful, particularly if you add in some extra volatility through that. And also from a preparer's perspective, in terms of understanding impairment and how that is calculated, if you're not quite clear how you've arrived, well, you're clear how you've arrived at the net book value, but whether that net book value does represent the underlying value of the asset, it's quite hard to justify an impairment on that. And then in terms of, I wasn't quite sure whether you wanted to cover off difficulty of preparation now, but
But
clearly having depreciation as a balancing number will cause some pretty significant issues. We don't know of any systems currently that can do that. So if you're doing that on every different lease, that's going to be a challenge. And when I say a challenge, it's a significant understatement. It's going to be very, very difficult. The reassessment of leases for changes in things like indexation on an annual basis would also be difficult. You can understand the idea behind it, but once you need to do that on a lease by lease basis, again, that's going to be quite onerous, and it could have some sort of pretty significant impacts in terms of the amount of work that we'd require to do. And then lastly, the disclosures. There's a pretty full list of disclosure requirements within the ED as it is at the moment. We did wonder whether the list of disclosures is so full because we didn't have confidence in the way that the rest of the standard was put together. I don't know whether that was the case, but it's sufficiently onerous for people to have to make quite hard choices in terms of what to comply with and what to fulfill in order to do things in a cost-effective way, which again could lead to differences in terms of disclosures for the users. So a number of concerns as to the amount of work required by the way that's put together, but perhaps more significantly concerns as to the way the model works in itself for Type B and whether it's too big a compromise in order to get the straight line for the P&L in terms of affecting the balance sheet.
But if I may, how would you achieve a straight line in the P&L without having the amortization being...
Well, it's a fundamental problem, because if you've got something that isn't of a financing nature and you try and make it a financing nature, you're squeezing it so hard that something is going to have to give. So clearly the way to solve it is to not put it on the balance sheet in the first place.
Okay, that's true.
So that would be my position.
But let's assume it's on the balance sheet, and let's assume you probably would wish that the liability be discounted, taken to its present value, unless you are happy to have it undiscounted.
But I wonder whether the assumption that the lease should be that the liability should be discounted is based on the assumption that it is financing in nature.
No, it's the fact that it is a long-term debt, and that if you can, you usually take it to the present value.
But you know, we make assumptions on how we amortize or depreciate fixed assets as well, so that isn't being done on that same basis here. So.
Could I just ask a follow-up question? You mentioned, Simon, the difficulties of having a system that would do the depreciation calculation.
Yep.
Could you also comment on, do you think that would create any additional impairment testing? Because your pattern of depreciation would be different than your consumption.
So there were three, just keeps the two key ones in terms of impairment. The first is if your amortization isn't on a straight line basis, or your use of it isn't on a straight line basis, but your economic benefits that you're achieving could be relatively on a straight line, then you could potentially risk impairment where it's not appropriate, or vice versa, not impairing where it is appropriate. Without modelling it out, it'd be quite hard to judge which way it would go. So that does undermine the requirement for doing impairments or some of the results from the impairments if some are done. The second, which was perhaps a little bit more tricky, and I hope I can explain this in the right way, is when we put the asset on the balance sheet at the start of the lease, you take the discount at that point. However, as your income then is discounted on different bases, as you do impairment tests in subsequent years, even if you've got completely matched cash inflows and outflows, you could end up with an impairment, which seems rather a perverse concept. So
you should have no trouble explaining that to investors, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there are difficulties for us in terms of impairment and understanding when does impairment happen and why it should happen from having this asset, which is fundamentally driven by the fact that the asset is created by trying to force the issue by saying that it's definitely financing when it's clearly not.
Can I just clarify that? And obviously, by the way, I've heard very clearly your views that you think property leases shouldn't be on the balance sheet. But then just to understand that, let's say if they are on the balance sheet, did I take your concerns around type B accounting then to say if they are on the balance sheet, you would prefer to go back to a single model where you wouldn't do the type B accounting but would flow through this financing?
It's not. I don't know whether I really want to take a choice between two things I don't agree with. However, losing the straight lining of the income statement, I think, would dramatically impact the usability of the accounts.
Okay, we take a round from the accounting professional representatives. I will start with Andrew.
Thank you. In terms of the question of two models, our view is that there should really just be one model. If we look at the proposals as set out in the exposure draft, they really are particularly complex, both from an accounting and a disclosure perspective. And to the extent that complexity shows the tension between the two different models and the extent to which the board have tried to come up with something which deals with a number of the observations which have been made. From a lessee perspective, we believe that all leases should be accounted for as type A. Without that, we believe that there would be quite a lot of structuring of leases in order to get type A or type B. And we also think that there would be quite a lot of arguments at the boundary. For example, what exactly is property? Does it have to be attached to land, for example? We also have quite considerable difficulty with type B leases from a conceptual basis. We find it very difficult to see why
there is a depreciation charge on the pattern that it's there. And we also find it very difficult to see a liability which is discounted on balance sheet but no associated finance charge. So that what we would really like to see is a model which is conceptually robust. And if it's more conceptually robust, we believe that that is a more defendable model. We'll come on to lessors in a minute or two, so I'll leave these just now. But these are very much the headlines. We would see a real need to simplify the proposals, and we think by having one model that would simplify it considerably. It would also simplify the disclosures. It would deal with a lot of issues that we hear in relation to the distinction between the two types.
Dan, on the same note.
Thank you. From our perspective would be, like I had mentioned before, we'd support putting leases on the balance sheet if it was done in a practical and principled manner that gave users of financial statements the information they needed. However, we're not quite sure that a type B approach or a type A approach gives users what they need for all types of leases. We heard, and the board's heard, that some users didn't find the front-loaded expense to be reflective of the economics and therefore wasn't providing decision useful information. We also struggle that the type B approach conceptually we struggle with understanding. Just and do struggle whether what user would be finding any decision useful information in the measurement of the right of use asset under our type B approach, the subsequent measurement. That amount as a balancing figure or other vernacular a plug does seem, at least from our perspective, we challenge as to who would really use that information, how would they use it. And the costs and complexities that would go along with applying a type B approach also is of concerns to us. Again, if we go to the premise and we take off the table the argument of whether or not we're going to put things on the balance sheet and whether leases are going to show up, what is it that users are really looking for? Are they just looking for the liability? And if they are, and we've decided that disclosure isn't an adequate solution, there should be an easier way to give them a balancing figure asset than the fairly complex type B approach model that's been out there. We think that model really is true. It's a compromise. It's not conceptually sound or founded. So perhaps another easier compromise, if your premise on needing the liability needs to be there and the straight line expense is more decision useful, something as simple as just a gross up on balance sheet dates where you do your same operating lease accounting as it goes along today. And then every reporting period, you're just grossing up your liability to your measured present value with an offset plug back to an asset. There is no way to measure amortization, but the amortization doesn't matter in your type B approach. So, again, could understand the approach, but struggle with the concepts underlying type B and whether that really is an improvement to financial reporting where it is today.
Herman, you already expressed a support for a single model, so any incremental input to us, or
not really. Point of our committee is pretty much in line with what Andrew said. However, the difference is that the committee would accept as a compromise that the two models would be applied, but again under the condition that the users would fully support that approach, and that would be ensure that they do not need to make any adjustments on the financial statements they are presented with.
So we will have to find a way to make sure there is consensus among the users. That will be a bit difficult unless we create a big, big conference, a worldwide conference, and we ask them to vote in the end with a majority view. But
so it's a try.
Martin, a solution to that.
Yeah, we can ask all the users in the room here.
And we get consensus.
This morning we're in agreement.
I'd like to follow up on your you asked, well, do users still need to make adjustments if we go to a type A, type B? Most certainly, yes. And the thing is, the other way around is users. If we don't do a dual model, or the dual model is based on the underlying economics of the assets, what users typically will do is decompose, just take off the current split, which is either type A or type B, and then need to make the adjustments themselves. And the type A, type B approach is will be, I'm convinced, will be seen as being so sufficiently accurate that these adjustments no longer need to be made. And I understand that companies struggle with the effort they need to get in to put into producing those numbers. But for every single company that forgoes on providing that split, hundreds or even thousands of analysts need to make a judgment themselves. And this is the cost associated with that should be taken into account as well. Can we already talk about cost or not yet?
No, not yet.
I guess my question is whether we should be striving for a model that users don't make adjustments to, or whether users will make adjustments to any model, or whether what you're looking for is a better starting point.
It's the better starting point. And there can always be specific circumstances that you read in the disclosures that help understand better the lease position. But the start point is incredibly ahead. I cannot think of a better model that's also feasible. You could argue even a 30-year building will have some depreciation, but this model just gets the balance right between being sufficiently accurate and providing and being feasible for preparers to produce.
By the way, I think that users are very independent people, and to dream of all users worldwide signing up to not making any further adjustments is just impossible.
I think considering the costs which would be incurred on preparers if these proposals would be put through, and considering that users would still go ahead and make adjustments, then I think our committee would suggest that the boards go back and consider whether it's worthwhile to stick to the current leasing guidance and look at the disclosure solution.
I heard that. Brian.
Thank you. We struggle with respect with this particular dual model, and I think it's worth focusing on exactly why, and perhaps some other people struggle with the dual model. And it seems to me that for the past 5 years or more, the boards have been developing what is fundamentally a single model. It's a single model that's about a transfer of the right to use, and fundamentally the reason that leases are on balance sheet according to this document is that there's a right that transfers, which is then paid for over time, and that seems to be the core proposal. But all of the discussion around this dual model and other dual models all seem to be about, one way or another, the characteristics of the underlying asset. Yeah. And it seems that people want to know things about the underlying asset rather than just the transfer of the right. And that seems to be quite a fundamental challenge to this particular model. So I can understand, I'm not saying I completely support, but I can understand a very pure right of use model, and I can understand what that's doing, but as soon as I move beyond that single pure model, I can have two models, I can have three models, I can have four models, but I don't see anything uniquely compelling about this particular one. And I have to say, before I saw it in the board papers, I hadn't heard anybody in the field analysing their leases according to this particular blend of underlying asset and consumption. And going back to the point in the Tesco discussion, I realise this discussion is framed in terms of all leases being on balance sheet, but I do think that the move from what's fundamentally a single model is actually quite a significant reopener for other aspects of it. This question as to how to recognise the liability on balance sheet with the straight line in the income statement Perhaps it doesn't have an answer because you've boxed yourself into having to face an unanswerable question.
Jacqueline, I will take your comments as part of the discussion on lessors, to which we will move in a moment. Right. Inc. and Richard, can you please limit yourself to anything incremental to what has been said by the accounting profession so far? And Andrew, you will be next to speak on behalf of the European Real Estate Association or whatever is it. So quickly, Hank.
Merci. I will be very short. Please reject the model of me type. Please go for a pure use of right model, for a fully conceptually sound use of right model, so that everyone knows where the dividing line is between a service contract and a use of right contract or lease contract. And that gives by us more clarity to the users and preparers, and all the liabilities are on the balance sheet.
Just quickly. I mean, in principle, as I've indicated before, I think we do see there are different types of leases, and so to some extent, the type A, type B is helpful, but quite clearly, it adds significant complexity. It's another boundary. There is all the problems of impairment and so on that are added in. There is a fudge in the middle or plug, whatever it was referred to as, and we have lost. We have lost, conceptual clarity that we had before.
So, in summary, one model.
Sorry.
One model.
No.
Okay.
I think fundamentally we think your closest type B shouldn't be on the balance sheet in the first place.
Andrew, you wanted to make some comments from the industry?
Yeah, I mean, from our perspective, we look at the listed real estate industry, which leasing is the lifeblood of what they do. I think, having taken soundings from our members, visibility is an important feature for investors, particularly when using the accounts. So the straight line approach of rental income gives investors a much easier way to get a handle.
You speak as lessors now.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Because a much easier way of being able to forecast the income in the longer term. And property is an industry where it's very easy to sort of benchmark one company against another. So we think the approach of treating investment property on the balance sheet and the income as rental income as it stands at the type B approach is the best use for our members and also the end users that use the accounts.
That takes us very nicely to the second set of questions, the lessor perspective, and you already gave one. Do we need to jump the question, or is it clear enough?
No, I think Andrew probably gave a very nice transition to hand over and let you, obviously given us your thoughts on the lessee side, if we had any views around the lessor accounting proposals, that would be great.
And maybe Jacqueline will start with industry perspective.
I will try. I think that it's difficult to talk independently about lessee and lessor accounting, especially if we're under the assumption of the right of use model. So I won't repeat what has been said. I agree with a lot of comments that were made. I think that the way the exposure draft is written, the dual model that we have on the table is not actually a right of use model at the end. We have to be a little bit careful about our language because people are saying we agree with right of use, but what are they agreeing with? Are they agreeing with type A for everything? Are they agreeing with type A / type B? I think there are lots of different motivations for saying I agree and I support right of use. I think you need to look into what people actually mean behind that. I fail to understand exactly what what users who think all leases are financing, how they can reconcile that view with the type A, type B version of right of use. I mean, like many people have said, if you buy into the right of use model, which is the game that we're playing now, you've purchased as a lessee a right to use an asset that you're financing with a related liability. And in that context, I think that you can only do something where you would have something like type A, potentially, so recognizing interest. And we have, at least Europe, also suggested ways where you could also overcome the front-loading effect that many people don't like with that model because of the conceptual premise that those things are all financing. From the lessor's point of view, I think the dual model doesn't work either. Again, it doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense to have type B lessors having the entire asset on their balance sheet when their clients would have a right of use. What have they given up? They're supposed to have given up something. It's not visible there. Now, that doesn't mean that we would necessarily, you know, say that lessor accounting doesn't need to be changed if you change lessee accounting. That's a discussion that the boards have had quite a long time ago, and just to remind you of the reasons for that. So if you go for a right of use approach for lessees and you leave lessor accounting as it is today, you end up with all those issues for subleases, the creation of multiple assets, et cetera, et cetera. So that doesn't work either. What you need, I think, is something coherently consistent, like somebody this morning said, not necessarily symmetrical, but at least consistent principles that lessees and lessors use. And I think the right answer is actually to leave the model as it is today. If you are in a right of use model, then there should be the same recognition of assets and liabilities on the balance sheet for all leases, and then a P&L that makes everybody happy. And the lessor accounting should be consistent with that. And that would mean derecognition if you under a right of use model.
Can I ask you, Jacqueline, obviously in the assumption, and I know in the assumption that it is a right of use model, and just thinking about your membership and lessors then, that if we say there is that transfer notion, and therefore for your members that would mean, and the proposals actually mean, I think for most of them having to recognise a receivable and residual, does that work from in terms of practicality for your members? Can they do it? Does it make sense?
It would not be their preference, but logically speaking, if we accept that the lessee has purchased the right of use from the lessor has sold that and should derecognize it. So yes, it's exchanging part of that asset for a receivable, and that's the model that goes with the lessee side for all of our members.
Hello.
Thank you. I suppose the headline we would start with is that we would like to have one model on both sides for Gordon Leasing Standard. But there's a proviso to that. And if I could perhaps start first with investment property. There are two particular issues there. One is that if you apply the right of use model and partial derecognition to lessor accounting for investment property, you could end up with enormous complexity. And one of the questions that needs to be asked is that complexity and difficulty in application actually worth it? And what are investment property companies showing anyway? Another part on the side for investment property companies is that they look at their properties in two ways. One is to generate rental income. The other one is to generate capital gains. That's how the business model works. So it's not necessarily quite a straightforward, we'll buy something and it's a financing deal, and off we go. So what we would suggest is that the leasing proposals would end up as being a conceptually pure single model, but for lessors of investment property, these would be scoped out completely. And that the guidance would then be placed elsewhere, probably from an IFRS perspective, an IAS 40. And you would have something which would be not far away from the lease accounting model that we have at the moment. And we think that partly from a cost-benefit analysis, partly from how the industry operates, that would be something which would be quite supportable. Similarly, in the interest of keeping things simple and avoiding excessive complexity, there are lessees of, for example, property who quite commonly sublet that property out. Many people have excess office space and they enter into relatively small leases and they sublet that property. And we would suggest again scoping that out and that similar approach to investment property companies there. In terms of the lack of symmetry, one or two people have already raised this. We wouldn't be too worried about having different accounting by lessor and lessee. It's not something which causes a particular problem elsewhere in accounting. For example, the seller of goods and services doesn't time revenue recognition according to when the purchaser happens to expense those goods and services. So we're not particularly hung up with that. But we do think that if that was done, the lease accounting standard would be simplified very substantially, and it would get things in a way which I think the users of financial statements, although I'm happy to hear otherwise, would find useful, and leases would come on balance sheet for lessees in a consistent way.
Thank you. I will take Brian first this time, and then Dan.
Thank you. I want to come back on the real estate and investment points, because there has been a lot of discussion about how the model would apply to real estate lessors. If there were to be a deviation from a single model for real estate lessors, I wonder certainly in an IFRS world, if one way forward would be that that model applied when the investment property is measured at fair value through profit or loss. It seems to me that that model captures most of the information that people would hope to get through application for right of use model. And also it seems like a more principled distinction because you're linking it to the measurement basis rather than just the nature of the underlying asset.
Dan?
I think look at the lessor model, it's just overall, it's not clear that the proposed model is really an improvement over what lessors are doing today. We haven't heard a lot. I don't know if the boards have heard differently, but we hadn't heard a lot of complaints about the current lessor model. Would strive or encourage the boards to have a conceptually consistent lessor and lessee model. But if there's some compromises you're making in order to do some things on lessee side, wouldn't necessarily need to impact lessor accounting. Perhaps one way to think about that, we didn't talk a lot about the dividing line and classifying in the dual model, but maybe a dividing line more similar to IAS 17 where we think about that and maybe it's under control versus risk and rewards to align to revenue, but a model that along those lines just seems there's a lot of added cost and complexity under the lessor model that doesn't really, I don't know if there's a problem there you're trying to solve. And if you didn't need to, is there a way to have it more similar to today's account?
Aman, from the lessor perspective.
Yeah, probably as mentioned before, we discussed for lessees the issues which were identified there, and for lessors, the issues may probably even be bigger and more significantly. This is why the ACG proposes not to implement the proposed requirements for lessors, but stick to the type B accounting for lessors, which is more or less operating leases in line with IAS 17, and of course keep the accounting requirements for finance leases as specified in IAS 17.
Atain, what do you think of that?
Yeah, first conceptually, from a user perspective, it's not a problem at all that lessors have a different asset on the balance sheet than a lessee. That's you tend to analyze a company and not so much the company and its client. You buy an instrument of a company and not of two companies. So it's what my opinion is mostly driven by what is useful for the analysis. Actually we support the proposals, but I do see
a lot of commonalities between the proposals and by scoping it out. I mean, basically, there's a lot of similarity, I think, between those two, except that from a disclosure point of view, I think it would be bad to scope it out, because for an analyst, it's important to understand the information about the assets that are leased out. So if you scope it out entirely, you forego on the disclosure, and then that makes life again difficult. But on the other hand, if you are pro scoping out, I guess you are pro the proposal, because that's more or less the same.
On the same note, you may have a contingent liability for litigation, which meets the recognition criteria in one company, the contingent liability, because it is more likely than not. So you book a liability under IAS 37, but the other party to that litigation might not meet the recognition criteria for this contingent asset. So we have here a difference, a lack of symmetry, and no one seems to bother about it. Unless Andrew wants to, to react.
I just wanted to react to that point. I think the question of whether you would lose disclosure of information would depend on the consequential amendments made to IAS 40 and what the boards then decided should be done. However, one of the reasons that we felt that a scope-out question would be cleaner is that it would avoid the arguments at the edges of what's in type A and what's in type B. Because if you say it's investment property, it's a cleaner distinction than the type A, type B distinction.
Simon, yes, if you're ready.
Very quickly, thank you. I just wanted to react on the fact that perhaps users, it doesn't matter to them if there's no symmetry or no consistency when they're looking at a company in isolation to make their analysis. And also on the comments about the need to be pragmatic. Of course, pragmatism is good. We want to find practical solutions. I just do think that the ISB does have a responsibility to get concepts right to some degree, because what you do here now, down the future, is going to be affecting public sector accounting, national accounts, SMEs, etc., etc. So when you're looking at national accounts in terms of an entire economy, then you do have problems about multiple assets and things like that. So looking at one single entity, maybe not. Recognize that's your primary focus, but you do set principles that the world will take into account down the road, and that shouldn't be ignored either.
Simon, from the perspective of lessors, are you a lessor as well?
We are a lessor as well, yes. So I can talk from that side too. So just to add a couple of very short points, and I noticed that quite a lot of the points around lessors are highlighting the difficulty of on balance sheet or off balance sheet for property, which I guess highlights and reinforces the point that I made earlier around the fact that property is perhaps slightly different in terms of the way it needs to be treated. But not to labour that point, just a couple of small, relatively small compared with that, issues around the dual recognition. One is just to recognise the complexity for intercompany transactions, and I take your point on the symmetry around liabilities, but the complexity per se of lease transactions as they're laid out is quite significantly more than just a single credit or a debit, so it does add quite a lot of complexity to it. And in addition, joint ventures, when they're consolidated, if the joint venture is a lessor, does mean you've got 1.5 times the asset on the balance sheet, and that doesn't go away on consolidation, and that will increase the size of people's balance sheets on a consolidated basis, which may mislead users.
Thanks. Well, I see we have no cards up. Oh yes, Brian again. You can come again.
I just wanted to respond to this question of, is it important that lessees and lessors are doing complementary, if not identical things? And it just made me think about sub-leases. So you say that it would be quite unusual to look at the lessor and the lessee. But if you had a group, say, that had been left with quite a lot of surplus property after a retrenchment, and it had managed to lease out all of that property, I guess under these proposals, it would appear to have a liability for its head leasers, but no matching financial assets for all of its subleasers, and that seems to be potentially quite practical example where perhaps it would be important to think about the lessee and lessor activity at the same time. I think Andrew raised the question of subleasers. Certainly there are lots of countries, as I'm sure Andrew will say, where most leases are in fact subleases. I think there are lessor lessee symmetry questions within individual entities that could be quite material.
Yes. All right, Martin.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to reiterate the point Simon just made about intra-group leases and intercompany leases, that it isn't just as simple as saying that they eliminate on consolidation, because they don't, particularly when they're between group entities which have got different functional currencies. It creates monetary assets and monetary liabilities which need to do the IS21 accounting for first and then eliminate. So to say that it, I think that that's something which really needs to be thought through, of how exactly you do the accounting for intra-group leases and how the elimination does work. Clearly, it needs to eliminate at an equity basis, but whether you end up getting P&L versus OCI flips as a result, you probably do.
Can I just ask, do you somehow view that we need to do something different and special for leases in terms of intercompany transactions that we don't do for other intercompany transactions?
I think that before going ahead and finalising it, you need to be conscious of how complicated it could be and work it through and decide whether it's worth it. I think that I recognise that with intercompany loans at the moment, you have FX, which could either go to OCI or P&L. But with this is going to create for us $18 billion worth of extra liabilities. Some of that, quite a lot of our big leases would be come in through one company and be intercompany leased to other companies, often between entities with the same functional currency, but not always. So it could be quite complicated. And I know I've asked this question in the past, and it's been responded that that's an IS21 problem rather than a leases project problem, but I think the response that I didn't think of at the time was, well, actually, it is part of the leases project that you come up with monetary liabilities in the lessee and under one of the models, monetary assets in the lessor. So it is a fundamental part of this model that needs to be thought through.
Yeah, thank you. May I suggest that you to submit certain proposals to simplify our situations, which is not easy, I agree. It's just a time for coffee break. Are there any reactions from ISB or FISB colleagues on discussion so far, or should we just wait for coffee? Right. Let's wait for coffee. 15 minutes. Please be back at 1:45. Thank you. Okay, thank you for being back on time. It is a guarantee that we will finish the meeting on time. So we will resume our discussions, and I think it's time to move to the next series of questions about measurement,
about variable lease payments, lease term, etc. Patrina, can you remind us what is exactly what you want us to discuss?
It's topic two in the paper, which we've headed up as measurement. Measurement of lease assets and liabilities is clearly an aspect of the proposals in the 2013 ED that looks very different from the proposals in the 2010 ED. So changed a lot, and the idea there was obviously to be responsive to concerns that were raised about complexity. But maybe there's more that we could do that we obviously ask in question 8 around do you have views on whether there are further simplifications that should or could be made, but without losing a significant amount of benefit. We've identified three separate sort of measurement areas in a sense that we're interested in your views on. And maybe when you give your views, if you could comment separately on those three different pieces to the extent you have views on any one of them. The first is determining the lease term. And obviously now we're saying that lease term is the non-cancellable period, plus where we think the lessee has a significant economic incentive. So your views on that. Secondly, around the measurement of variable lease payments. And thirdly, of course, because the asset liability is measured on a discounted basis, your views on the discount rate that's to be used in the proposals for discount rate. Again, to the extent that you have different views on the initial assessment at the start of a lease versus ongoing reassessment, it would be useful if you distinguish your views in those aspects that perhaps you might say you agree with, making an assessment at the start of a lease but don't think there should be reassessment. So with that, over to you.
Right, volunteers. We start with Martin.
Thanks. So I'd like to make two comments, one on variable lease payments and another one on discount rate. So on variable lease payments, the point that I'd like to make is around what exactly we're trying to get to with in substance fixed, whether in substance fixed is really trying to get to anti-abuse, is it to get rid of the ridiculous things that might be written into a contract just to make it look variable, or are we meant to look further there? So an example that we give in our comment letter is for drilling rigs, where the amount that you pay per day is often based off, depends on whether it is available for use, so whether it's functioning. So these drilling rigs would typically be available for 95% of the time, but not all of the time. 5% of the time, they may be down for maintenance, there may be storms, whatever. So we get to a place where you could have three answers, which are all very different. You could either say, well, in the contractually, they need to make it available to us, and until that's happened, the lease liability would be zero, and so we'd recognise zero. Alternatively, we could say, well, in substance, it's there for we have an obligation to make the payment on the assumption that it is available. Therefore, we'd recognise 100%, and then for the 5% of the time that it's not available, we'd recognise negative variable lease payments of the 5% during the course of the year. Or alternatively, we could say, well, it's going to be available for 95% of the time. We'll recognise 95% of the payments up front, and we'll true it up at the end of each year, depending on what exactly has happened. So are we trying to get to situations like that? So availability based, we also have where there's different rates depending on whether the drilling rig is on standby, so not being used, or whether it's actually being used for drilling. So the drilling rate would be substantially higher than the standby rate. Which rate are we meant to use when we're determining the initial amount to recognise as the right of use asset, and how much should be the true up? So I think that it would be helpful if that were clarified. The other point I wanted to make was around discount rate. So for some large items such as ships, it's quite common for the lease payments to be based off to vary with LIBOR, 3-month LIBOR rate. So if you've got a 5-year ship lease where your payments are being reset every 3 months, the requirement to reassess the discount rate every 3 months as LIBOR changes, and then change the right of use asset, change the lease liability, that is extremely onerous, and we don't really see why that is particularly helpful. Clearly, we would be reassessing the lease payments at the same time that we're discounting, but it's not symmetrical because we're being asked to come up with a revised discount rate that reflects the remaining lease terms. So for a 4.75 year lease at the end of the first quarter, which is clearly nothing to do with the 3-month LIBOR rate that we're adjusting the payments by. So, I mean, a simple solution there is do not require reassessment of discount rates, you know, particularly for those kinds of leases. That just seems to introduce huge amounts of complexity where we don't see why we would have to do it.
Can I just clarify your views there? You're saying don't reassess discount rate. Does that mean in terms of the liability, don't also uplift the cash payments that are included in your liability? Just, you know, so if your contractual payments change because the discount rate changes, do you think we should be updating the cash payments and not the discount rate, or just actually don't have any reassessment?
I can see an argument for why you would update the cash flows, because just to be consistent with the way that you're doing it for FX rates, or the way you're doing it for inflation, or any other kind of changes to the cash flows. Changing the cash flows is doable, but changing the liability because of the discount rates, not so much.
Joaquin, any views on that?
Yes. First of all, I think that we would like to recognize the major simplifications that have been made. There's been a lot of steps in the right direction when it comes to measurement, so that's very helpful. Nevertheless, we think the model is still inherently complex, but if I just limit my comments to three things on the lease term payments and impairment issues for lessors. On the lease term, we understand that the boards are trying to get at a higher threshold with significant economic incentive. I think it even actually says that in the paper that we had for today. And it also says that it should be basically equivalent to reasonably certain. If that's the case, then really we recommend that the standard itself uses a reasonably certain, because otherwise significant economic incentive might be or will be open to interpretation differences in application. It might be more difficult for users to understand how that has been applied across entities. Also, significant economic incentive is seen from the lessee's point of view. That can be difficult for lessors to always assess whether or not the lessee has a significant economic incentive. And in that respect, I wonder perhaps if a term that wasn't used this morning could actually even be more clear and less subject to interpretation. Maybe the virtually certain concept would be helpful. And then just on this theme, I think that we would like to see some kind of threshold also built into the short-term exemption, because otherwise you could end up deciding that you don't have a significant economic incentive to extend your lease as a lessee, but not be under the exemption and end up having to account for 10, 11 months of lease payments or whatever it may be. When it comes to lease payments, and the discount rates, I think we have similar comments there as what was just said. What we would do when it comes to the payments, when there is a change in the rate or an index, we think those should just be recognized in profit and loss when the change occurs. And lastly, a few comments on impairment for lessors. I think we understand that at first sight, and this is something that we have spoken about with you, we understand that at first sight might be logical to simply refer preparers to IAS 39 or what will replace IAS 39 for the receivable and IAS 36 for the residual asset. But we're concerned that this would lead to lessors recognizing impairments in cases where the net investment in their lease is still recoverable. So we think that lessors should compare this net investment in the lease to the underlying asset. And we've put forward suggestions for presentation and things, how that could work in our comment letter and our submission to you. And then looking at asset risk, we think the best way to handle that is to ask or to require lessors to adjust the accretion of the residuals so that the residual is trued up, if you like, or becomes what the lessor's most recent forecast value of the lease, the value of the leased asset is at the end of the lease. So those are things that we would encourage you to look at.
And
Yeah, this view on impairment we heard many times from industry in various countries. Thank you. I think, Henk, you were next in my list.
Thank you, Philip. What we wondered is whether these optional terms, depending on whether there is or not a significant incentive, do not recognize that kind of thinking in the current IAS 37 model. As we understand it, IAS 37 says that there is an obligation, when there is a real present obligation, then there is a liability. How does this model fit into IAS 37? That is one of our questions. Is that still within the borders of IAS 37 and conceptually right? Might the board decide to continue with this project, then we can concur with this concept that you should include these optional payments with a major incentive in the liability side of the balance sheet.
Same topic, maybe Dan, on the options and the measurement.
First, I think from a lease term perspective, we strongly support the board's change from the longest possible, more likely than not, measurement in the 2010 ED to one that's based on a significant economic incentive. I do think the actual language of significant economic incentive is a little more transparent than reasonably certain or reasonably assured. So actually supportive of the additional guidance that the boards have included in terms of measurement of lease term. From variable lease payments, are supportive, again, of the changes from the 2010 ED in terms of measurement to what came out in the latest exposure draft, and are supportive of not including usage and performance-based contingent rentals in the measurement of liability. And the discount rates, we're supportive of the guidance you put in there, the implicit rate if it's available. In providing guidance on that. The one place we'd ask the boards to consider is whether there are any pragmatic reliefs that could be provided in the form in relation to reassessment, whether it's in terms of a periodic reassessment, you know, we suggest in the comment letter maybe an annual basis, something other than a continuous need to reassess for all changes in potential factors you'd consider in terms of lease term reassessment, but broadly supportive of the measurement basis and supportive of the need to remeasure and reassess, just suggest or recommend looking at ways to maybe make that a little more practical.
Herman, what's the view of your committee on this topic?
With respect to the lease term, there is overall agreement, but specifically with the variable lease payments, there are two areas where some proposals are submitted. One is relating to the index or rate-based lease payments. The reassessment required for these specific variable lease payments appears to be quite burdensome because it would require, at the end of each reporting period, an update is necessary. And also, in that instance, you would not get to a final number. So it is a continuous adjustment or reassessment exercise, which probably needs some easing. And the other issue relates to what has been mentioned by Martin before, that there should be some more guidance with respect to the in-substance fixed payments, because it looks like their divergent practice would emerge if you do not provide any additional guidance.
Well,
I think the proposals are clearer and simpler to apply than the previous ED, specifically on lease term, which a couple of people have commented on. Clearly under this model, that would be an enormously important estimate initially and subsequently, and I think it's perfectly valid and probably quite helpful to have additional guidance on how to assess the lease term. But I do think, similar to I think what Jacqueline said, if the idea is to get to something that's essentially the same as we concern, then it would be very helpful to have a very clear statement that that was the intention. I think everybody is going to spend an awful lot of time deciding what lease term is in the run-up to implementing this, so a very clear statement would be very helpful. On reassessments, this is a potential area for simplification, I think we would support reassessing the lease term, because that seems to be a very, as I said, a very, very significant judgment, and it would seem very, very strange not to reassess, get to the end of the originally estimated lease term, and then suddenly discover you have something to account for subsequently. So we would support reassessment of the lease term. I'm less convinced of the benefit of reassessing the variable lease payments based on an index or indeed the discount rate. When we model typical leases and look at the impact of the reassessment, the impact on the P&L account seems to be really quite small. And perhaps Martin's going to comment in a minute about the value of effectively grossing up the balance sheet by equal and opposite amounts. But it seems that you don't get much value in the P&L from that regular reassessment of the indexes and the discount rates.
We will finish listening to the views of the accounting profession with Richard, then I move to preparer, Simon, and then last word would be for Martin on this topic.
Thank you. I think we do think this area has been significantly improved from the last time, and removing the contingent estimated rentals is a big improvement. On the lease term, I think we would like to keep this as simple as possible, because I think, as other people have said, there's going to be quite a debate about how to do this. So, in principle, we would have liked to stuck as closely to the legal obligation, including residual value guarantees. There is quite a lot of language here which may get in the way a bit. We've got substantially, in this standard, we've got substantially all, we've got major part, we've got not more than insignificant or insignificant. So there's quite a bit of difficulty. I think people are going to be in grading some of those adjectives and trying to translate those into results. I would try to keep the lease term as simple as possible. I think largely in line with the legal obligation.
Simon,
thank you. A few points. One, clearly, if we don't agree that the lease creates a balance sheet item at the start, then for an option that hasn't even been agreed yet or triggered yet, it's quite hard to justify taking it further. But putting that aside for the sake of the conversation now, a couple of thoughts on the lease term. So first of all, I was interested to read in the agenda for today that significant economic incentive is meant to be similar or the same as reasonably certain. I think if that's the case, can we call it reasonably certain and stop a massive amount of work trying to work out what the difference between the two is and then reassessing absolutely every lease on that basis? So unless you've got a really driving imperative to create a difference or a different hurdle rate, then why don't we just leave it as it is, which is something that, whilst there may be some differences, is something that people generally understand for their own businesses.
But do you think that, or would you accept that reasonably certain is of course a judgment, and that having a significant economic incentive might help you in assessing whether something is reasonably certain or not?
No, absolutely, and I think that the economic incentives behind it are in the existing IS17. To an extent, so it's a component part of that. I think that if you look at the reasons behind a lot of leases, it's to give flexibility, particularly with respect to options and extensions and break clauses. And that optionality is to mitigate risk and is also to enable improved returns by switching an investment from one place to another. So by eliminating that judgment and eliminating what the break clauses and break clause and extension clauses are actually designed to do, you're actually coming up with a perverse result of defeating the underlying structure of the leases. My last point was on reassessment, so it's just to back up those people who said that reassessment, particularly of index-linked items, will be particularly onerous, and it will be quite a lot of work to do, so we would prefer we didn't reassess things annually and just stuck with what the initial assessment was at the start of the lease.
If you allow me, Martin, I will take Andrew now, and then you will be the last on this topic, I promise.
Thank you. I'll be brief. From our perspective, we very much support a lot of the changes that have been brought in. We think that it makes the proposals much more operational. On the point of a significant economic incentive, we're broadly content with it, but I can see that if you were explicit that you didn't expect very many changes, that would be quite helpful. Two particular points to pick up on. On the contingent rentals, we also agree that the reassessment has the potential to bring a great degree of complexity. And so it might be worth looking at whether you really would get a very different answer if you treated the changes as simply being contingent rentals. And that would greatly simplify the approach and mean that there was much less work to do on an ongoing basis. The only other point is one which is FASB specific. There is a proposal for non-public entities to use a risk-free rate for the purposes of discounting. That is something that we would not be in favour of. Entities don't use that at the moment, and if they used a risk-free rate, then the numbers which would arrive from that would not necessarily be close to those which would arise if they used a discount rate which would apply to that.
Right, so now the investor view on these terms.
Thank you. On significant economic incentive, our impression is that it is more objective. We support that. On the variable lease payments, this will, whatever split you, whatever you choose, it will be difficult to analyze. You mentioned three scenarios, what should we do? And one thing I think will be highly insightful for analysts is to have a table with all the lease expenses which are indeed capitalized on the, for which the right of use asset is on the balance sheet, but also to know what kind of lease payments were made under variable lease payments, so that you get a sort of a gross amount, and then you can see as an analyst the difference between, okay, total lease payment is 100 and last year 20 of that was variable, and hey, we see the 80 we see on in the P&L. If those numbers really change over time, big time, then at least you have a conversation with management so you can understand what is what is really developing. And again, if it's not material, I don't want to know. There must be a material threshold here. So I think this table that does exclude payments for take or pay and things that are just not related to assets, but includes the variable payments, would be very helpful. On the discount rate, I do have some different thoughts than the board at the moment. I think currently the wording is the incremental borrowing rate. And I think, I mean, I'm looking at preparers now, so it's quite difficult to pinpoint what exactly is our incremental borrowing rate, because it could be multiple. You could issue a junior bond, you could use your credit line at the bank. There can be very many different incremental borrowing rates. I think the discount rate that applies here is basically very close to a very high, very well collateralized loan that is that would be comparable. Why? You have a financing arrangement where the asset that you lease serves as collateral to the lessor. If you stop paying, he will come and revindicate, repossess the leased asset. So basically, you have a quite secure loan with hardly any risk on the principal. If you compare it to a collateralized loan by a bank, it could be still cheaper because it's the core business of a lessor to manage those leased assets. Whereas if you have a mortgage at the bank, it's usually not the core business of the bank to rent out, to find a new lessee for a piece of real estate. They will try to sell that. So I think the discount rate needs to be addressed in the final standard. That's my comments.
Thank you. Well, have we sufficiently covered this section? Is there any question from board members, from the staff, or can we move on to the next one? Oh, Ted?
Yes, please. Okay. Quick question then. In the basis of decision on the, when talking about the lease term, I think there needs to be some clarity when we introduce a significant economic incentive. Was the goal to find a like principle to reasonably certain, or was it to raise the bar? Because, you know, I think what's very important here is we have to do what's best to define what a liability is in the conceptual framework of a liability. So that was just a question. Wasn't clear for me when going through the.
Maybe I'll try and clarify, and the board members can tell me if I've misarticulated their views on the topic. But and I know it's obviously come up a lot that people have said. I mean, the quote in this paper comes out of BASIS, where the boards confirm that they expect a significant economic incentive threshold to be applied in a similar way to reasonably assured and reasonably certain, which of course naturally would say, well, why bother changing it then? Why not? I suppose the view which was there is that at least I think there is some words in US GAAP. In IAS 17 today, there just are those two words, reasonably certain, with no other words to tell you how to go about applying reasonably certain. Now, obviously, we understand that practice has developed where people have now got a good understanding of where that is and how to apply it. It's just that because there's only those two words, at least in terms of what the words in the standard are, it's not clear to us whether it's not clear to us in terms of course, absolutely. You know, we I suppose couldn't say it was clear that the boards thought it was appropriate that for their, you know, for you to include optional periods, there should be an economic incentive. Should be based on there being an economic incentive. Now, because those words of economic incentive is not in IAS 17 today to tell you how to apply reasonably certain, the boards felt that that would be a clarification, mm-hmm. that clearly there should be an economic incentive, and for the reasons they said, that that would provide a bit more of an objective basis as to how to do this, to try and clarify it's not necessarily about hitting a particular number in terms of probability, etc. So it was there to try and clarify to say there should be an economic incentive, and if we think that's the case, let's put those words clearly.
We also heard from one preparer this morning that there might not be consistency between reasonably assured and reasonable certainty. That is, maybe this is a fresh start, that some apply, you know, one piece of language one way and some apply it another.
I think for us, we like the fresh start. I mean, I think now we're talking about a model where we're considering every, or as the exposure draft says, every lessor's lease is going to be on the balance sheet as a liability. And so I think it's very important to make sure we have a concept that will define what is a liability.
not what management intends to do or anything, but what really is a liability. And if I look at significant economic incentive, I'm looking at something so significant that I'll be compelled to literally spend the money in the future. And so, you know, one thought we had is maybe the best way to define this term is economic compulsion, or something that's a little, you know, along the lines of what we're reading as a liability, or what a liability should be.
We don't quite like the economic compulsion notion. It's being considered as part of the framework, but it seems to be an external factor to a certain extent, whereas here, management is faced with its own decisions, but they have to behave in a way which makes sense to the investor, to the shareholders, that is to do things which really are aligned with our business. And a significant economic incentive usually is more an internal view, it's a preparer's view, rather than economic compulsion, which might be some form of external factors.
But take the point, if we're trying to figure out what a liability is, tying that into the conceptual notion of a liability is probably useful for people.
So I think economic incentive itself is not a liability, but if it's significant, then I start thinking, okay, liability.
Yeah.
So it's a bit philosophical, but it's going to have to come down to a judgment evaluation. So.
Manuel, you wanted to come on this?
Yes, on the same topic, we had a discussion with among the business Europe, and we considered that if significant economic incentive and reasonably certain were to be alike, we would rather keep reasonably certain, because we see the significant economic incentive as a quantitative threshold. And many of us were afraid that auditors would ask for scenarios and discounted cash flows between different scenarios if we were changing the threshold.
But
if we were to do a fresh start, maybe it should be precise that.
But would you agree to having maybe reasonably certain as a key term, but having this economic incentive, significant economic incentive, as an indicator of when things might be reasonably certain or reasonably assured? Because if we keep, as we have today, only those two words, reasonably certain, no one knows what it means, really. Everyone can have a different view of what is reasonably certain to him.
Yeah. Today we have no difficulty in applying it, so we don't need that addition. I understand that if we want to have US preparers and IFRS preparers to use it the same way, we might need a change. But
today,
we don't need the economic incentive today to apply reasonably certain.
You don't have the operating leases on the balance sheet. Tomorrow you will have them, and then the big question will be, and the options to extend are probably more linked to operating leases than to finance leases, I suppose.
At least for me, thinking about reasonably certain and then the definition of a liability, that's where I struggle a little bit, is reasonably certain I'll pay payroll next year, but it doesn't make next year's payroll a liability. So something within a framework that makes that reasonably certain payment a liability.
But I do have a significant economic incentive to pay salaries next year, and I still don't put them in the balance sheet.
I think leasing is a unique situation, but we would ask just to consider what the liability is and use that as a basis of deciding what the right way to choose what additional renewal terms or termination should be included. So.
All right, okay, thanks. Shall we move on, Petrina, to the next series of questions?
Sure. Topic three, we're moving on to its next scope. We've identified two areas around scope that we're interested in your views on. The first, of course, is the definition of a lease and identifying whether a contract contains a lease versus whether it's a service contract. Clearly here, the definition itself is unchanged from existing requirements in the previous ED, but what has changed is some of the guidance and how you actually think about that notion of control when you're assessing whether a contract contains a lease or not. So interested in your views on that. Secondly, of course, once you've determined that a contract contains a lease, then you're asked to separate out, obviously, the amount you're paying from the lease separately from any amount that might be within the same contract, but you're paying for services. So again, any comments around that separation of lease and non-lease components?
Uh,
Yes, please, Martin.
Yeah, sorry to go first again. But,
oh, someone has to do it, and it's good that someone puts up the card because then everyone would want to speak.
Okay, so I think the big problem that we have is in distinguishing between what is a service and what is a lease. What is a service provided using an asset, and what is a lease of an asset? And there's a couple of examples in our industry that are probably worth picking out. So going back to drilling rigs, so when have we leased a drilling rig, and when have we entered into a contract with our supplier for them to go and drill a well for us? And what is the boundary between those two, between those? Because it will make a significant difference to our financial statements. Similarly, in shipping, when I've got a spot charter where I've just asked for a shipping company to take cargo from A to B, is that a lease? What about if it's a time charter where I've got the ship for a year and it's going to go from A to B to C to D to E? And for us, it feels like a spot charter is a transport service, and it feels like a time charter is probably a lease. But what difference between the two? And we can't really rationalise why one would be and one wouldn't be. So it feels like they both are or they both aren't. And similarly, with that, and this relates to both drilling rigs and to ships, where the owner of the asset, the lessor, inverted commas, is providing the crew, to what extent are we controlling that asset? We're not controlling it day to day, but by specifying we would like a well to be drilled here to such a depth for so many kilometres, is that us controlling it, despite the fact that it is the contractor who is actually operating the machinery and positioning it and putting it into place? So I think that we can arrive at an interpretation. I think that others could arrive at different interpretations, both within the context of the standard, and neither of us would be wrong, but we would be different.
Can I ask you a question just about that? In terms of what you said, if we take our, say, spot charter versus time charter, and you said that your thoughts are that the spot charter is more like a service and the time charter more contains a lease, are you getting to that conclusion based on intuitively what you think, or are you getting to that based on reading the guidance with your intuition on top of it?
That's intuitively where we think it should come out, and we're struggling to get to where what we think intuitively is right with the guidance.
Okay. And is it that you're getting to a different answer? It's more there isn't enough in the guidance you think you could get to two different answers?
We think we could get to either answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Depending on how much emphasis we put on different fact patterns. There's one other area that I wanted to comment on as well, which is again pretty prevalent in the oil and gas industry, and that's relating to joint operations. And again, I've asked this question before and been told that it's an IFRS 11 problem. But I think that it does come down to the definition of a lease and what is meant by control. So we have control as a fundamental part of the definition of a lease, and IFRIC 4 paragraph 9C goes out the window, and we focus on control. So if I'm in a joint operation, clearly I don't have control because I have joint control. So there's a tension there. The way we think it should be interpreted would be to say, you look at the contract. Does the contract convey transfer control to something, which I guess would be the joint operation, even though it's not an entity, but does the joint operation obtain control of that, even if only one party to the joint operation has signed the contract? And if you get there, say yes, it's the joint operation here that's the lessee, then I, as a joint operation partner, I will then recognise my 30% or my 40% of both the asset and the liability, and then that will give me kind of sensible economic answer. I mean, that's kind of where we think we should be getting to, but I know that there are some others in our industry who don't interpret it that way, who would say, well, if you're the person who signed the contract, then you recognise 100%, and if you're a partner which hasn't signed the lease contract, then you recognise 0%, and you just recognise your cash calls as they come through. So I think that there's something which needs to be done
either in the final leases standard or as a consequential amendment to IFRS 11 to clarify which of those options, which road you should be going down. And my US GAAP is extremely non-existent. So I guess to ensure consistency between IFRS and US GAAP preparers in the same industry, doing something similar in US GAAP probably would be helpful too.
Noted.
Thank you. I will continue this way. Søren.
Yes, from our perspective, we agree to the scope. We could foresee that there could be some challenges determining whether it's a lease or it's a service. But if we have the right scope of the contracts, I think we can overcome that. But our challenge, or what we foresee, is this big burden of many contracts we need to take care of small ticket items. And we do acknowledge that this short-term lease has been built into the standard. But we would also like to see another way of implementing a threshold. Otherwise, it will be the different companies who needs to define that by themselves and fight with the auditors and so on. If we could have a common practice on how to determine materiality, that would be nice. And one way could be, of course, looking at the financial value, but it could also be looking at whether it's a core asset or a non-core asset. I don't know if you have discussed that during the process.
We have discussed at length the core assets, and we have concluded that it's difficult as a criteria because some might be material and some non-core might be immaterial as well. So we have decided that the materiality principle should apply here, and that doesn't need to be specified in a different way than for capitalizing your fixed assets or expensing your fixed assets.
In saying that, we look forward, obviously, to reading all of the comment letters that are just coming through the door over the weekend and as we speak, and there may be a magic answer to that in those comment letters. So we will read with interest.
We expect that.
Yes, we expect that.
Continuing to my right-hand side, Andrew.
Thank you. In many respects, we agree with what's in the exposure draft. Just one or two thoughts and things where that made us pause a little bit more. We weren't convinced that the dividing line of what's a lease and what isn't a lease should depend on who happens to supply the consumables or the spare parts. We can think of quite a number of situations outside coffee machines where the lessor is the sole supplier, and you might inadvertently find that things that you thought might be captured by the leasing standard might fall outside it. On examples 2 and 3, the coffee machine where there's a sole supplier of consumables, and example 3 where there's medical equipment where you're contractually required to take all the consumables from the lessor, we didn't see a substantive difference between the two. We think you've got a lease in both. And we think that you need to think a little bit further about the scoping of that, not just for these examples, but looking a little bit wider at other industries where you might get a surprise. We also felt that you didn't quite capture as much as you ought when we looked at example 5B, which was the electricity supply. And we were thinking of that rather in terms of arrangements which are currently within the scope of IFRIC 4. Which we think should still be within the scope of the leasing standard. And again, we can think of a number of arrangements where if the proposals and examples were taken forward as drafted, these would fall out. Thank you.
Let's continue up now, Brian, on this one, going this way.
Brief contribution. I would stick with IFRIC 4, to be honest. It seems to me that this question of what was a lease will be the number one application issue if there were to be a standard based on this ED. I think there would be many discussions amongst preparers and auditors as to what was a lease, and we as auditors would be presented with many clever structuring ideas by lots of very, very clever people as to why arrangements weren't leases. So I think changing the bound, this just seems to me to not be the right time to change the definition or the boundary. I'd be open to going away and thinking very philosophically for a long time about what the difference is. But if you're going to finish up with something that's sort of the same but a bit different, you know, I'd just stick with you.
Thanks. Hank, on the same issue?
Now, opinion, you really need the illustrative examples to determine case by case. Is this a lease situation, or is it a grey area, or is this a service contract? So what already has been said, it will lead to much discussion, what we expect. And why is a lease contract an executed contract, and an other contract, a maintenance contract, or other kind of contract, an executory contract? It is not clear. So again, I would like more deeply conceptual analysis of what is really a right of use contract and a lease. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Herman?
Yeah, the ASCG was quite happy with the definition of a lease and also with the separation of components. However, there are some areas which would like or would need some improvement or clarification. And the first one is the term substantive right to substitute. At least in the application guidance, some further detailing would be very helpful. The issue with respect to joint control, I think, has been properly addressed by Martin before. And there is another issue where the dividing line lies between protection rights on one hand and the area where there is no control over the underlying asset anymore. Some clarification probably in the application guidance would be considered helpful as well. And then there have been quite some discussions on the determination of what an observable standalone price is. I recall specifically one instance where there was a discussion of a production plant which is taken to real life for the first time worldwide, and you have that production plant together with the workforce, and obviously you would not have any observable standalone prices for that specific instance. So again, some guidance would be very helpful there. The examples within the illustrative examples have been addressed. I think Hank just mentioned that, and Andrew as well. And the final issue is, I think that was discussed this morning as well, with respect to small-sized equipment and small parts. That still is an issue that many people think that type of leases should probably not be subject to the requirements. But again, the golden bullet I cannot provide, and I guess we may still be looking for it.
Dan, the auditors have been put on the spotlight for this discussion on materiality, and maybe Brian, if we want to come back to that also, and Andrew, do you think that not having the smallest items on the balance sheet based on the idea they are not material could work in practice, or are you the guys who are going to be the pain in the neck for this?
We're going to be a pain in the neck. I mean, just to be—I think you guys did try to take on the scope out for non-core assets, and I personally, you know, Dan versus the EY view would say I don't know that there's going to be a magic silver bullet for that to come up with a level of materiality just for leases, unique and separate from everything else under IFRS. So, but I would say, you know, in thinking about scope, I'd echo what I think Brian's comments were that. We think scope is going to be one of the biggest implementation issues. It's one of the questions we hear about the most when we go out and talk to constituents out there. And we do find the alignment of the control concepts and the application guidance under the definition with the concepts other places to be conceptually appealing. And we can understand how that could be an improvement over IFRIC 4. But we think you need to build the framework out a little bit more. One thing we would like, of course, is more examples to help go through how to deal with issues around both determining whether the entity has the ability to direct the use of the asset. We highlight a few factors in our comment letter around arrangements where a lot of decisions are made in the contract and trying to decipher, well, who made that decision? It was mutually agreed upon in the contract. How do we think about those? As well as the concepts of being able to derive the benefits from use. I know that's a couple examples that have been highlighted a few times. So we would like more application guidance, but not just in terms of examples, but also maybe building the framework out a little more, in that if we need 100 examples in order to apply the model, we probably don't have the model quite right. So I think it's fleshing out the framework more and then supplementing it with some of the examples of the tough issues that we dealt with in outreach. The time charters I heard already, the drilling contracts, those are the ones that I know gave us headaches as we thought through it. In terms of separation lease and non-lease components, one item that we do raise that, you know, to think about providing guidance is, in terms of executory costs, it's often a question we get is whether or not, how to think about executory costs in a lease. We have concepts under U.S. GAAP, how we think about executory costs. We have concepts in IFRS today about how we think about those sorts of costs in terms of doing our lease accounting. It's very frequent to find leases with executory costs within them, and it's a common question. We implore the board to put some guidance in what you're thinking around executory costs were in terms of whether or not those costs are staying in as lease components or coming out, potentially as non-lease. And we've heard differing views, again, talking to different people, you have different views with the language that's there, getting to different answers. So,
Kathleen.
Thank you. I think this is indeed the key issue, and this is going to give rise to the most implementation difficulties in practice. We've tried to give you wording to help improve the situation, but it's very difficult, and we actually have concluded that it's not possible to significantly improve. The only way to improve would be to get around this issue would be to go back to something like IA 17 and that distinction driving recognition. I think that there is also an issue a little bit about how the standard, the guidance, and the examples interrelate. We agree, for instance, that examples 2 and 3 are not what we would have expected. We don't think that the fact that there's an entity different to the lessor, the supplier providing consumables, should determine whether or not the lessee or client has a lease. We thought that both cases were actually not leases. We thought that was quite clear. I think we'd invite you to think about whether the guidance and the examples actually do effectively get across what you're trying to say in the body of the standard itself. I won't say anything more on this issue because I think you do know our views, but when it comes to separating lease and service components, I think that there have been improvements compared to the first ED. There are only two areas where we would still have concerns. First of all, from the lessee's point of view, we think that when there are no observable prices, you shouldn't unduly penalize that lessee and require capitalization of both lease and service components, but instead you should let the lessee make some kind of reasonable estimate of what the service components are. And on the lessor side, I think there's a reference in the standard to the revenue recognition language. We're just concerned that that language doesn't fit with the lessor's economic reality. Lessors will always have the different information on different components, otherwise they can't put those contracts together. But instead of referring to the revenue recognition guidance, which talks about things being highly interrelated, integrated, and customized to suit the customer, in that case, I think the lessor would not be allowed to separate, and we could... We think that you could argue, or you, somebody could say, for example, in the case of a full-service contract hire for a car, that the service and lease components would be highly interrelated, integrated, and customized. So even though the lessor has that information, that wording is perhaps not the best, and we think the solution is just to remove the reference and ask the lessor to do it based to do the split based on the information that it does have, that it used to price the lease. To build the contract.
Thank you. Emmanuel, of course, you have a point on the company cars being employee benefits, but beyond this issue, any comments on the separation between leases and service contracts?
Philippe, we had a chance to talk about this issue, but maybe not with the work group, and it's an issue that I've rarely heard So I really would like to go back to it and maybe go a little bit into the details, because when I read the ED as it is today, even though I was thinking that we might need some clarification on that. So on paragraph 18, we see that the customer's ability to derive the benefits from use of an asset refers to its right to obtain substantially all of the potential economic benefits from use of the asset through the term of the contract. So this defines the asset in the lease. And my point is related to assets used by employees, where the company may have signed the lease. So the company is actually financing the car. There is no doubt about it. So we have the liability side. However, what is questionable today is whether the asset should be in the balance sheet, because for company cars, employees have the use of the asset for a significant part of the asset. So the point is more to maybe clarify that. We talked about this issue with other Business Europe people. And if we consider this as a sublease, this is not clear, because this is not a contract of subleasing the car between the company and the employee. So there might need some clarification about the fact that those assets should be part of the
So what do you think we should do? You have the liability. You want to expense it, or what do you want?
No, to us, it's more something that should be scoped out for assets that are actually used by employees.
But you have the liability, right?
Yes, this is where from the beginning, the starting point to say that all financing contracts should be considered as leasing. Maybe this is one type of financing agreements that actually are not leases, and because of the right of use asset, which is actually not a right of use for the company.
Yeah.
If help me understand, if a company bought an employee a car, it remained in title of the company, but let their employees use it, would that not be an asset of the company?
So we see a difference between cars that are actually controlled by the company. So let's say that we might have cars with the logo of the company, or cars that are not used by employees, or trucks. So for those type of trucks, whether they are acquired or leased, they would be part or in the scope of the lease as it is today. But we also see cars are chosen by the employees that are not managed as a fleet, because what we see are trucks or cars managed as a fleet, and we would definitely see that in the asset of the company. But when they are actually really chosen according to the employee and the size of the family, we consider that they are more a compensation in substance, and it would be more comparable to leave it as it is today, which is recognized over the service that is rendered by the employee.
I'd be happy to discuss this further with you after the meeting, but my starting point is that you have an asset, you have a liability.
We might...
We can discuss more.
Yeah. Well, I think Emmanuel speaks about those situations where actually the car is a fringe benefit for the employee. And the contract is signed by the company, but the real user is the employee. But still, that doesn't mean you don't have a liability. Soren.
Yes, maybe just a small comment related to the cars, but it could also be other assets. In practice, we have a materiality threshold for PPEs. So that would mean in many cases, even though it's qualifies for an asset, we would expense it because it's too low a value. So if we bought the car, we would expense it. Now we lease it, and we need to capitalize it on the balance sheet.
Why do you think you have a lower materiality threshold for leases than for items of PP&E?
That was just my interpretation of the standard.
I don't think it was intended to establish a different materiality threshold.
I'm hoping the auditors in the room wouldn't disagree that we'd apply a different materiality threshold.
I think we already had Brian and Emma.
How are the accounting standards written for purchases different that you were able to come to that conclusion?
I don't think the standard are written differently, but it's just years of practice. and yeah, placed us on all of the discussions and so on. That was just my interpretation, but maybe or hopefully I'm wrong.
Do you want to go first?
I would just add, I've heard that comment before. I agree we wouldn't have a different materiality, but in talking to preparers, it's not an unusual initial term commonly heard.
The fact is that maybe in looking at the assets that you purchase at expense, the only criteria maybe is what is the impact on your balance sheet, on your P&L, by expensive. Here you have another element, which is the liability, the amount of liability. And if you build a multi-criteria assessment of materiality, then there might be some discussion about whether the liability is material because it takes you in or out of a covenant. It takes you... it's probably more complex in assessing the materiality when you have a liability than expensing an asset.
So what was your conclusion then?
I wouldn't have looked at the right of use asset at a different materiality than a owned asset.
And in fact, that comes back in the circle to the photocopiers and the small items. That I think that from an audit perspective, most companies will have a pretty good idea of, for example, how many photocopiers they've got out there and what the annual cost of them is. So if you've got these typically in 3-year leases, you can work out pretty quickly if there might be a significant effect. And to the point of would there be a different materiality threshold for the leases standard or purchased equipment, I can't see it being different. The question would be, what would the effect be? And even if the effect wasn't all that huge, if has been suggested, it might trip over a debt covenant. It might trip over a certain very important ratio. You might think a little bit further about it. So I don't think you can give a very definite answer on it, but there are certainly fairly rough and ready ways that you can look at it before you then decide to go look in more detail. But I'd be happy if my colleagues from the other professionals have commented.
Thank you. I think in the interest of time, we should maybe move on to the last series of topics, which is about transition and disclosures. Katrina?
Yeah, absolutely. With 10 minutes to go, we're on to topic 4, which is, of course, other aspects. We've highlighted in the paper 2 other aspects, which is transition and disclosure. I know we've already had a couple of comments on disclosure, but if anybody else has any comments on transition, disclosure, or any other aspects, please, we're keen to hear your views.
Jacqueline, you're first.
Thank you. I'll be very quick. Katrina, can you confirm that there's a typo for the disclosures on short-term leases?
let me know if you're addressing your point, whether I'm not sure if it's a typo or a clarification. I have seen actually already in some comment letters, and I know you raised it, to say it looks like you're providing relief on recognition and measurement for short-term leases, but then all the disclosure requirements apply to short-term leases. There's no scoping out, so it looks like you've taken away the benefit. It's clearly, obviously, way too subtle in our intentions, but just to be clear, the reason we didn't was that I think virtually all of the quantitative disclosures link into what is recognised on the balance sheet, which means, in effect, the quantitative disclosures are not required for short-term leases in the proposals. It would really only be the qualitative piece in saying that.
Okay, would that include, then, classifying short-term leases as type A and type B? I think there needs to be some consideration given to that.
So at least the intention wasn't, I think, that you shouldn't have to do all kinds of quantitative information for short-term. But we can certainly, it's at best too subtle, and we can make it clear.
Maybe before we move to the standard suggestions, maybe Martin on disclosures and transition, you have a...
Two points on transition. So appreciate that the modified retrospective approach is easier than full retrospective. I think it's worth just highlighting that it is still going to be quite a lot of work to go back because for each lease, you need to go back far enough to identify when the commencement date was in order to apply the modified retrospective approach correctly. And so that gives some relief, but it doesn't give a huge amount of relief. And similarly for sale and leasebacks, which need to go back and identify all historic sale and leasebacks which are still in operation in order to get the accounting for those done correctly on transition. So it's it's helpful to an extent, but if there's anything else that could be done to reduce that, that would be excellent.
Do you have any suggestions?
I mean, I guess go back to what was in, I think, the 2010 ED and just give an option at least of putting the liability at the transition date onto the balance sheet and dealing with the front loading. Allowing that as a choice so people can work out whether the cost benefit for them works for them. And the other point would be if we, in terms of comparatives, not requiring any comparatives in an IS 39 style from 2005 would be first preference. Second preference would be to get to where you got to for IS 10, 11, 12 and just require a single year of comparatives, but do that immediately rather than later on, please.
Then, quickly, as Martin said, just to reiterate and support him in his last comments with the disclosures and going back in comparative years, we're not so confident that information would necessarily provide the users of financial statements any more clarity on trends or on, you know, comparability from year to year. And so we would support that or recommend that we wouldn't have to do the comparatives. It's going to be very burdensome and expensive. If they are required, there's one question that we have as a filer in the U.S., and that is what would be the requirements of going back in the selective financial data, if any? Would we just be limited to the financial statements, or would there be any requirement to go back even further to the five-year presentation and select the financial information? And that's a question that we have.
Okay, thank you. Dan?
In terms of transition, do think it would be a big undertaking for preparers. And one thing we'd encourage the boards to think about is some of the later changes and decisions around transition and the revenue proposal and whether or not those could be affected for leases, if you could do more of a retrospective approach, but not the comparative year. Again, needing input from users about the decision usefulness of the information in the comparative years. But in talking to preparers and talking to a lot of preparers, they do seem to find a lot of benefit if they didn't have to do the back years. So just something to share.
Come on.
Yeah, two comments, one on IAS 40 and one on short-term leases. With respect to IAS 40, the ACD would not support that the right-of-use assets would be treated as investment property if they meet the definition of investment property, and that is because there should be clear distinction between owned investment properties, owned investment properties, and rights, other rights like the right-of-use assets. And with respect to short-term leases, the issue which is quite important for continental Europe is cancelable leases, and that issue is addressed in the basis for conclusion. However, the proposal or the suggestion is to remove some of that guidance, that elaboration into the main part of the standard, because that would help to clarify how to deal with that specific type of contracts. And the other issue relates to leases which do not meet the definition of a short-term lease, but which are having a lease term of less than 12 months, which is quite possible in certain circumstances, and the relief provided to short-term leases should be given to these leases with a lease term of less than 12 months as well.
Sure, I understand this distinction between short-term lease and lease of less than 12 months. Can you clarify for me?
Yeah, if you have a lease which does not meet the definition of short-term lease, you have to make a judgment on what the lease term is based on your significant economic incentive. And if you do that, you may end up with a lease term, which is 12 months or less. Mm-hmm. And for that specific case, the relief for short-term leases should be provided as well.
Okay, I understand. Andrew?
Thank you. I would just echo the comments that have already been made about transition. We would very much appreciate seeing simplifications on that, either by way of a cumulative catch-up in the period of adoption or something similar to IFRS 10 and 11, where you look at the date of initial application at the start of the current period and base everything on the conditions in existence at that point. That would also enable leases which are coming to the end of their term and so will expire within 12 months from the start of the current period simply to be dealt with and ignored, which would ease the transition quite considerably. On disclosures, there are some disclosures where we think perhaps there's a little more than is absolutely necessary. The detailed reconciliations we think might be looked at again. On the other hand, for variable leases, consistent with our comment that those that are based on indexes might be treated as having contingent payments, it might be useful to have some additional disclosures about the extent to which contingent payments are expected to be made in future periods. There may need to be a little thought for things like leases which are based on a proportion of turnover from a particular location of whether that might effectively result in a forecast being made. But it's worth just looking to see if something could be enhanced there, which I think would be useful for users. And the other points have already been addressed, so thank you.
Thank you. So maybe, Martijn, I think you will have the last word for today, as usual.
Well, I'm sure you all now have the impression, and that's right, that users can't wait for this standard to be approved and endorsed on the shortest possible notice. But even if so, it may take several years before it will be effective. The years of 2017 and 2018, depending on who you're talking, 2025. I think it will be very important for users that there will be already some consistent disclosure on what the effects will be of the then effective standard, and just leaving it open, what kind of insight already is given may be a bit may not be good enough. Maybe the standard could include some comments on what what kind of insight should be provided as of 2014.
I'm afraid I will have to make an exception to what I said, and I prepare to have the last word. But it will be the real one, real last, right? And be short, please.
Yes, thank you very much. It's just I would like to say thank you for taking the time and listening to all of the input from so many stakeholders. I think it has been a good day. Can I be so frank and ask you what has made the biggest impression on you, and what is the process from here?
I would say I should not do that. Maybe the staff can give some.
Clearly, everything that's been said has made an impression on us. And everything that we have heard, quite seriously, this is an important part of the board's process and staff's process of obtaining feedback from different perspectives. These kind of forums really help add a bit more flavour around when we read your comments and comment letters. We can only say that all of what we've heard do filter into all of that package of what we hear via meetings and via comment letters and everything else, and this will feed into go forward and get discussed by the board.
If I may add, I would say that if I compare this what we did 3 years ago, there's a much more mature, much more informed discussion, and I think it took 3 years to get there, but I think we have learned a lot in the meantime. I think we still have improvements to do, but I think we have learned a lot.
Personally, I must say I would like to thank you for the frankness and the real active participation in our discussions. Clearly, there is a difficulty. Some would like to see one model only for the lessees. Some think that properties are different and should deserve a different treatment. So there is no consensus, and we will have to make a decision, not an easy one, but we will continue to think about it. And thank you very much for your participation, your comment letters, and have a safe way back home.
Thank you.
Thank you.